Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD, Thursday, the 1st of December. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very happy to be sitting opposite Dr. Art Sear from the faculty of Carthage College, my most frequent morning show guest, and this is likely the last visit that we will have in the calendar year of 2022, but I appreciate all of the conversations that we have had over the years and look forward to many, many more. Professor Sear, in addition to his work at Carthage, is also a columnist whose work appears in newspapers all across the country and outside the country as well, also author of After the Cold War, and my guest today to talk about a number of different pressing issues and concerns. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, Professor Berg, it's always a pleasure, partly because the central heating is always extremely good in this building. I must compliment you. It's not the only reason I show up.
But it is a draw on a day like this. Yes, Mother Nature has been rather fierce. So, but anyway, I'm glad that you are here in this season shortly after Thanksgiving. I'm thankful for your continued presence on the morning show. We'll get to Thanksgiving in just a moment. I want to briefly talk about a couple of bigger issues that I think we'll touch on only briefly. One of them, of course, the recently completed midterm elections, and of course there had been widespread predictions that there would be a massive red wave, which did not quite materialize as some had expected. I'm just curious if you were surprised at all by what the ultimate results of the midterm elections were?
Well, I'd like to say nothing surprises me, young man, and that's why I don't have any special inside information. I have learned to become skeptical of the polls since 2016. Nonetheless, I was surprised because generally the party that has the White House loses some seats. It's almost like clockwork. Sometimes it's not very many, and this time the Republicans have taken over the House at this point, it's fair to say. So in that sense, it's worked, but the party obviously has a weak image and has some problems in terms of mobilizing voters.
I think what was especially surprising to people is, given that President Biden's approval ratings are quite low, that would have indicated what you said almost always happens in the midterms would probably have happened in an especially big way, and in a sense just the opposite happened.
Yeah, well, there's a very, there's a much more controversial, much more well-defined figure on the scene, the 800-pound gorilla, or Godzilla, from the point of view of critics, Donald Trump. And he's been going around making mischief in ways that have directly hurt the party. He endorsed a lot of candidates, many of whom are quite extreme, to put it politely, but a number of them did get nominated, and they got clobbered at the polls. For people like me who are not particularly, I'm very critical of Trump in terms of my own personal views and politics, which is of no consequence except he remains a very, very powerful figure on the scene. The fact that his endorsed candidates didn't do well, I think directly hurt the Republicans. He's also raised a tremendous amount of money, but he spent very little of it on Republican candidates. The Wall Street Journal had a very insightful editorial, a conservative publication, of course, but very critical of Trump editorially in the last few years. They weren't so much initially. They made the point that Mitch McConnell really deserves a lot of credit, often criticized from the right in his party. Actually, the party did as well as it did because he was far more responsible, shrewd, and rather selfless in making sure that conservatives as well as more moderate Republicans got elected. So to give you a short answer for a change, it was, the Trump factor. And there are also issues that on balance helped the Democrats as issues. The decision on Roe versus Wade, which did not ban abortion but return decision-making to the states by the conservative majority on the current Supreme Court, that obviously was a factor, and your associates at National Public Radio emphasized that dimension. That's an important issue, but not, it's an issue that cuts both ways, by the way, and it's not the only issue. I think it was Trump, and finally, you can't beat somebody with nobody, and President Biden may be unpopular, but against Trump, he doesn't look so bad. And in any case, the president was not directly involved. So I don't think it's in any way historic, but it shows the Republican Party has work to do. Just because the president's in the basement in poll ratings doesn't mean Republicans are going to win big, whoever they finally nominate in 24.
They cannot afford to be complacent. I thought what was really striking in terms of talking about extreme candidates that generally speaking did not do well except in certain pockets of the country.
But in
particular, I've read this in a couple of places, that what really did not go over well with the vast majority of voters were those candidates that were kind of at their heart in terms of their issues, election deniers. I mean, those kind of calling into question the whole process of the integrity of voting and the integrity of our elections, that for somebody who trumpeted that particular cause, they almost without exception did not do well, that seemed to be an issue that did not rest very easily with quite a few voters, which I found really interesting.
Yeah. Since the 1960s, our system has become overall far more honest and far less corrupt. Things that were part of politics, until
those smoke-filled rooms, you mean?
Yeah, and I actually kind of like smoke-filled rooms in terms of what they can produce. Harry Truman, President Truman, for instance, among a number of others, also leaders who aren't so good. But how have we done since they were abolished? We still have a very mixed picture politically.
Sure.
But in terms of old-time corruption, there are people in federal prison now who are doing things that were part of everyday politics until the 60s. A very experienced Illinois politician who almost got elected governor told me, Neil Hardigan, he was attorney general, lieutenant governor, a product of the old Daley machine. He almost was elected governor in 1990. I spent 2 years working with him and others, very good, mostly younger people at the World Trade Center in Chicago, getting them out of some difficulty and greatly strengthening their balance sheet. Quite an interesting education for me. The organization, I can assure you, we kept it clean and solved some minor IRS problems, did not fire anybody. I'm very proud of that. I was also very glad to leave in 98 and come up to Carthage College. But anyway, Neil, who is busy at a very demanding law firm, McDermott, Will & Emery, did occasionally stop by on his way down to see his friend, former Congressman Ross Tomkowski, who was in Stateville Prison. And this was in the 90s, and he pointed out to me, I think it's a very insightful observation, that the goalposts have been moved. Congressman Ross Tomkowski is not basically a criminal or, you know, not organized crime, but he got caught up in a changing system. So overall, it's quite, we Americans should be very happy about the way our system is working.
Right, and not take that for granted.
Yeah.
And I think the election shows that.
Well, we shouldn't take it for granted, but also there's, you make a very good point. Nationally, Trump has not gotten any substantial traction with these claims that have been pretty much discredited by the facts that somehow the election was stolen.
Right. I also wanted to ask you briefly about this matter of a potential railroad strike.
Yeah.
And it's always kind of interesting when suddenly everybody is talking about railroads when most of the time nobody talks about railroads except maybe people who work in that industry or work adjacent to that industry. But, you know, railroads are just... and maybe if you ride Amtrak or something, but I mean, we just don't spend a whole lot of time talking about trains, and then suddenly there's the potential of a strike, and suddenly, oh my gosh, what if something happens to the trains? And it just makes you realize how oblivious Americans tend to be about something that is so crucial to our infrastructure.
Well, perhaps in the rarefied atmosphere of public radio, there's not a lot of discussion of trains.
My guess is, by and large, Americans don't stop to think about trains as much as they should and how much we depend on them.
Well, I'm glad you said stop, because Americans who travel by car, we spend increasing amounts of time at railroad crossings because of the nonstop traffic, mostly freight.
Yeah.
Passenger traffic is increasing in this country. And since you bring it up, older people, a rapidly growing percentage of the population, young men, especially older women, increasingly are drawn to public transportation. And railheads, when you have passenger train stations, literally commerce blossoms. It wasn't too long ago that Governor Doyle, in this state, at the end of the last century and the beginning of this one, gave tremendous emphasis to passenger rail.
Oh, yeah.
And it's going to continue to grow. Until 1963, you could get on the train in Chicago at Union Station or Northwestern, I think more likely Northwestern, and go directly to Milwaukee. I think that's coming back. Meanwhile, a huge amount of freight moves by rail, and a huge number of workers, mostly but not exclusively male, are involved in that. That's a subject that I hope more attention will be paid to.
I do, too.
By public radio, actually, they're a very good employer. You have very good pensions. You don't need a college degree. And those pensions are directly guaranteed by the federal government. Mm. It's a very, very good place for working people to work.
Right. And it's I guess my main point is just, I think most of us walk around not mindful, not sufficiently mindful of the fact that so much of what we, you know, grab from the grocery store shelves or whatever,
yeah.
I mean, the medications that show up at Walgreens and all kinds of other things that trains that we might see at a crossing once in a while, I mean, are vital to that. What would it mean to our country if we were to be enveloped in a rail strike? I mean, maybe that's a little less likely now with the U.S. House passing a bill.
I think it's a lot less likely.
But I mean, what would that mean if such a strike occurred?
It would mean a lot of inconvenience. The economy would not shut down. Truck traffic would increase even more significantly when we're not stopped at railroad crossings, especially people who use the interstate a lot, which I do for commuting and partly for business. We're dodging 18-wheelers right on our rear bumpers, which is a huge change in the culture over the last half century, especially. But anyway, I think, you know, other alternative forms, it's been a great boon to this area as well. I think the more we can talk about how things impact Kenosha, Wisconsin, the Illinois, Wisconsin sort of Great Lakes area, the better. More than half the interstate truck traffic in North America, including Canada and Mexico, goes through this area.
Wow.
294, 90, 94, 80. The Chicago-Milwaukee metro area has a huge amount of traffic. Main factor in why the Rust Belt moniker is no longer heard all that
right.
much. We are extremely well located, and people should keep that in mind when the news is bad.
Right.
It would not lead to a broad recession or another Great Depression or any kind of increase in unemployment. Another factor why the Republicans did not do better is President Biden may not be the most magnetic, gripping, inspiring figure in the White House that's ever been our president, but the economy is very good. We have essentially full employment.
Mm-hmm.
Which is extraordinary, historic. Just it shows the profound power of this country's economy. Just
right.
extraordinary.
Right, I agree. By the way, with trains and Governor Doyle's wishes to dramatically expand passenger rail service
right.
in Wisconsin, one of the things I remember being so striking about that was the fact that the coalition that was behind that crossed all kinds of barriers. It was people on the left, people on the right, environmentalists and business leaders all wanted to see that happen. I mean, not every single person, and of course, ultimately, nobody wanted to pay for it. But I mean, it was an exceptionally broad coalition when it came to those who were supporting commuter rail expansion in Wisconsin, which was a really striking thing to see. I mean, in an era when those kind of factors don't tend to agree on very much. But they agreed on the potential for what that expansion would have meant.
That's a very insightful point, Greg. I'm so glad you made it. And it also shows a profound reversal. The railroads used to be the heavies, succeeded by the oil companies and other corporate villains. Mm. But well into the 20th century, the railroads were uniquely powerful, sort of maybe like telecom today. And greatly feared. More, an average of three people were killed at unmarked rail crossings in the city of Chicago into the 20th century. And when public authorities tried to get the railroads to do a more responsible job, they were told, in effect, go to hell.
Mm.
And if you really caused trouble, the railroad barons would kill you.
Wow.
Or have you killed? I mean, that was a cost of business way back in the good old days. So finally, a huge coalition of all the other major businesses in the Chicago area, plus workers to a degree, plus the increasingly powerful Democratic political machine got together, and they literally reined in the railroads, forced them to be responsible corporate citizens. And we all benefit because the railroad barons had plans to build enormous warehouses and freight yards right up against Lake Michigan. So thanks to the fact that the political power structure, those politicians, those smoke-filled room guys got together, that's why we have a beautiful Chicago lakefront, and it's not some kind of god-awful, ugly, dangerous area. there's been huge growth in rail yards in southwest of the Chicago metropolitan area, also never discussed in the news, that reflects just how significant transportation is to our economy. And I certainly hope you will go forth and preach the gospel to others in public radio and television, and so we can cover this issue, including the tremendous benefits for working people today of rail and transport.
Right.
But they're tough employers. They're tough jobs, especially in trucking.
Right.
Which gets to your point about unions.
Yeah. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Seer, Clausen Distinguished Professor at Carthage College, and my frequent guest on the morning show. Yeah. Yes.
We've discussed this off the air. All right.
That's force of habit. I apologize.
No, that's all right. No need to apologize, but let's make this the last time.
Right.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Please.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, my God.
So we have just crossed the Thanksgiving holiday, and you had a column, a beautifully written column about President Abraham Lincoln, who, of course, is responsible for there being a national day of Thanksgiving. But your column points out that we should not only be thankful to President Lincoln, but also to an extraordinary woman who was instrumental in that holiday being developed. So I really appreciated you telling the story of, I think it's Sarah Josepha Hale.
Yes, I think you probably even pronounced her name right. Yes.
Imagine that. So tell our listeners who won't know that name why she figures so prominently in this story.
Well, I didn't know her name until I started working on the column, an initial version, a while ago. She was the editor of Godey's Ladies book. I think it's Godey's Ladies. I suspect not even Grandma is familiar with that publication, but back in the 1800s, it was, a combination of Vogue and the Ladies' Home Journal and Life and Look and all those publications that are not around anymore, really. It was very, very powerful with the female population in the country. And she felt we should have Thanksgiving and had been writing presidents for decades about having a Thanksgiving holiday. I didn't know any of this till I started working on the Lincoln column. And individual states did recognize Thanksgiving. There was great national awareness, but it didn't become a national holiday until, I believe, 1863. She wrote to Lincoln in September of 63. He had issued a preliminary proclamation in 1861, his first year in the White House, ordering all government federal offices closed to recognize the importance of giving thanks to our Father in heaven. Again, a different world from today, a very Victorian proclamation. But he read her letter. One of the things about Lincoln is how phenomenal he was at getting things done. No telephone, no motor vehicle, no cell phone, even the sheer amount of work this man was able to do. He had able assistance, but he himself did a tremendous amount. He actually took note of her correspondence and answered her politely. And in 1863, he issued the executive order that we have a national Thanksgiving holiday. It was extremely well-timed in terms of the United States war effort, the federal effort against the secessionist Confederates. Things were coming together after horrific losses for about a year and a half, 2 years. Things were starting to move in the direction of the Union. And with great comprehensive vision, he was able to use this, not at all cynically, but use it in a very effective way to reinforce his Emancipation Proclamation of at the beginning of 63, freeing slaves in the Confederate states, and build on growing Union power.
At one point you say in the column, talking then more specifically about the Emancipation Proclamation and what it said and what it didn't say, and about the way in which, the measured way in which Lincoln went after this goal of ultimately freeing the slaves, you make mention of Lincoln employing astonishing political skill and the fact that he seemed to have a really great understanding of what could be done versus what should be done, or what should be done when, or what needed to happen before other things could happen, as opposed to somebody who might have chosen to act much more rashly and of course, maybe undermine the very things they were trying to bring about.
Yeah, I think that's very well stated. He did not actually control the Union Army in any unquestioned sense until the fall of 1862, after losing in the East. Meanwhile, General Grant and Sherman were winning and winning big in the West, but in the Eastern Front, the main one, the Union Army suffered a whole series of defeats. Finally, General McClellan in September of 62 won a victory at Antietam. Robert E. Lee retreated in order. The Confederate Army was still very much intact, but he left the field. Antietam, Maryland or Virginia, it's pretty far north in any case, Antietam Creek, and they simply couldn't sustain the South, that kind of force that far north after they were fought to a standstill, so they left. Lincoln seized on the opportunity to, for one thing, General McClellan, the commander, he was pro-slavery, he was also pro-Union, he was very reluctant to fight, especially from Lincoln's point of view. In fairness to him, he was very much aware of just how horrible war had become. Mm. By the middle of the 1800s. So he demanded control over all war policy, which was just what the president was waiting for. Lincoln, he didn't want to mess with kindly Abe. And, you know, he was extraordinarily good at putting the kibosh on enemies, if not immediately. So he immediately seized on the opportunity to fire McClellan. He finally, for the first time, had control of the Union Army in the East, and he used that as the basis to be much more aggressive in warning the South that we are going to seize your property. And that's the way he approached emancipation in the South. The Emancipation Proclamation, the Lincoln administration was able to get a couple of laws through Congress called the Confiscation Acts, again confirming his war power, telling the South, we are taking your property. This is not a declared war, but you are in violation of the law. We are seizing your property. You're criminals, in violation of increasingly clear federal statutes. On the basis of that, he issued the Emancipation Proclamation in early 63. He'd finally established presidential authority in the way we understand that. And he had this nice letter from Sarah Joseph Hale, and he'd already laid the groundwork for a positive Thanksgiving message. Mm. All kinds of things came together in his head. The Emancipation Proclamation is a dry legal document. It doesn't make any moral references. We're going to seize property, and slaves are no longer under Confederate control. He transformed the war from the war to reunite the Union, in effect, to a war against slavery. It was very important because the British and French governments were playing and toying with the idea of recognizing the Confederacy. Mm-hmm. Jefferson Davis, Lincoln's counterpart, was working far less efficiently and far less productively, but one of his top priorities was to get the British and the French in on the side of the Confederates. Wow, if they could do that, like the French and the Dutch helping the Americans, crucially, in our revolution, they could have won.
Oh, that could have changed everything.
Yeah.
Wow.
Once it became about slavery, there were British aristocrats who really liked the South, and Southern agriculture was, especially cotton and rice, was essential to the British, enormous British economy. But once it became about slavery, there were still aristocrats who liked the idea, but workers across Britain, including in huge industrial centers like Birmingham and Manchester, said, you were discussing unions earlier. We're not working. Mm. Yeah, you can find somebody else to do this work if you start recognizing a slave state.
Wow.
And the timing was great. It ended any possibility of those very powerful nations in the world then saving the Confederacy. Mm. Additionally, the Union was finally winning in 63, right after the Emancipation Proclamation, and just before his Thanksgiving Proclamation. We started winning big. Grant and the Western armies he controlled took over Vicksburg, confirming Union control of the entire Mississippi River. And, of course, General Meade was able to actually win significantly against Lee in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
And the tide truly turned then.
Absolutely. Yeah, but the ability to orchestrate, that's true leadership. You cannot just give orders and hire and fire people, but when you can orchestrate resources, in this case at the most challenging and terrible level war, it's just an extraordinary example of executive leadership.
The time is 8:40. You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm so happy to have Dr. Art Sear with me to be talking about an array of very different issues and concerns. Two different recent columns have both approached the topic of free speech in really intriguing ways. One of them involving a court decision in the state of Florida that essentially struck down something called the Individual Freedom Act, which, despite its name, is actually really not about freedom, but rather about prescribing the way in which certain things would be taught and the way in which people would be referred to in terms of appearance, their ethnicity, and so on. The other column referring to Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter and his decision, in a sense, to kind of release what had been, in your mind, at least rather heavy-handed censorship that had occurred at Twitter. I mean, you and a number of others, of course, have made that observation. So it was kind of an interesting coincidence for this issue to kind of arise in two different columns, focusing on the issue in two different arenas, but it really speaks to kind of rising concerns about our own right to free speech and personal privacy and what that means in 2022.
Yes, indeed. Elon Musk, as everyone knows, has bought Twitter, and lots of excitement excitement follows this particular business leader, no matter what he's up to or what he's doing, given his style and given his enormous wealth and therefore influence. The column was very critical of what I think is uneven, definitely not even-handed censorship and moderation, as it's called in the trade, on the part of Twitter. Everybody knows that they banned President Trump when he was in the White House from Twitter, and Musk has reinstated him with a great drum roll and a whole orchestra. And
I think Elon Musk does everything with a drum roll, doesn't
he? Exactly, yeah, much like Donald Trump. And the president has said, no, thank you, I'm going to stick with my own social media platform. I can't remember the name of that one. But the Ayatollah, the chief religious leader in Iran, he's on Twitter. He regularly calls for the destruction of Israel and the burning of all Jews. And, according to the previous management of Twitter, that's fine. Mm. He's just expressing political views. But anything Trump comes up with, of course, that's criminal. That's horrible. We've got to agonize at length. So I'm very glad that point of view on the part of people who had great... I'm very glad they're gone, and that's the end of the story.
The thing that I found really interesting as you wrote about this is you talked about how concentrated power remains dangerous.
Yes.
And I thought that was a really good observation to make, because I think in a lot of ways, this world of the internet, you know, is not about the concentration of power. It's, in a sense, of the diffusion of power. It's like everybody has access to this thing. Anybody can write anything. There's, in some respects, a dramatic democratization when it comes to something like the internet. You don't have to be rich. You don't have to be powerful. You don't have to be reconnected. So in some ways, it's sort of feels at its heart to be about the diffusion of power, giving everybody, in a sense, a voice that they maybe never had before. And on the other hand, even in this world of the internet, there do indeed remain these pockets of concentrated power and authority that I think you very rightly point out are really dangerous. I mean, that even in that vast landscape, there are things like Twitter, there are things like Google, there are things like Facebook that retain an enormous amount of power over people's lives and with very, very little oversight, for instance, from the government. And it is something we have to be really mindful of. And I think I'm not sure that we are sufficiently mindful of that. But this whole story about Twitter probably brings it to the forefront.
I think you're very insightful in making that point, Greg, and you make it very effectively, as usual. Twitter especially, but also other things in the social media world, are generating mostly grassroots political pressure to Congress to become more active and proactive, which will lead to even more drum rolls and more melodrama and more to-ing and fro-ing in Washington. But is really a good thing, more significant because it directly bears on the global economy and whether things crash or not is cryptocurrency, which is not really money, but is treated like money. It's really big-time gambling from my point of view, and we're so rich in the industrial world. There's so much liquid capital collectively that something that would have been unheard of even a generation ago has now been attracting a lot of capital. Finally, the administrative arms of the now Biden administration and also Congress is becoming very animated about the subject of cryptocurrency. It's still a very small proportion of the total financial system, and that's one reason why regulators have been complacent. But it's now significant enough with the ongoing collapse of companies that were clearly engaged in fraud, that and criminal deception of actual and potential investors, that regulation will become much more. And the Wall Street Journal, again, I don't particularly agree with their editorials, but they're a very good source of news that's serious and professional about what's going on in the economy. And they have had a couple of very persuasive editorials about how high-profile celebrities, that's where the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, especially, but also other arms of the government, including the Justice Department, that's where they've been focusing. They really should be doing more and more nuts and bolts work on antitrust work, on potential fraud. The SEC has spent an awful lot of time going after, what's her name, the really big, prominent socialite, social media influencer. They've actually prosecuted her for endorsing products. But they've been leaving crypto alone, and I am hoping that will change. Yeah.
It's interesting the different issues and questions that get raised in this new world, and of course, it's all emerged so quickly.
Kardashian.
Professor Sear didn't know the name Kardashian off the top of his head. That's a shock.
Yes, I'm proud to say I'm really out of it.
As am I.
And want to be.
Yeah, as am I. Yeah, right.
Kardashian free.
Yeah. I wanted to say that all of this has sprung up so quickly, so no wonder there are kind of awkward questions that have to be wrestled with. We have to kind of figure a lot of things out quickly. But your column about Twitter and Elon Musk actually takes us back to John F. Kennedy and the fact that although we are quick to credit him with kind of galvanizing the space race and getting us to the moon, that in fact President Kennedy deserves great credit for something else that nobody talks about, but which is absolutely essential to this amazing interconnectedness that we all experience in the modern world in terms of technology. Just remind our listeners about this this accomplishment by President Kennedy that is so largely forgotten.
Well, thank you very much for bringing it up. Yeah, he's rightly credited with literally launching the manned space program. Eisenhower was actually opposed to manned space flight, but instrumentation and very serious space exploration really began under Ike. He thought manned space flight was far too expensive, far too instruments could do it better, potentially horribly dangerous. And Kennedy, much more attuned to the his time emerging really emphasized the importance of manned spaceflight for all kinds of symbolic and emotional and political reasons. The Soviets were at that point ahead of us in terms of actually getting men into orbit. And we got to the moon and back to Earth. JFK was always careful to include. By 1969, he had been dead for more than 5 years, but that legacy continues, and thanks to George W. Bush, we've relaunched a program to not only go back to the moon, but eventually go to Mars. And Elon Musk says he wants to die on Mars, and there are a lot of people who wish he, not me, but there are those who wish he already weren't around. It's romantic, but it's also tremendously important. Cell phones result from the miniaturization of the drive to get to the moon. It's an enormous strategic program required. Mm-hmm. Miniaturization of all kinds, lots of health benefits, lots of knowledge about people. So Kennedy's instincts were right. But he also made the Communications Satellite Corporation a privately chartered corporation. There was tremendous pressure in the Democratic Party, including from Southern conservatives, but nonetheless populist Western Democrats. It's a very different Democratic Party from today. But populism, anti-business sentiment, was extremely powerful. He took tremendous heat. When I was a kid, I started reading The New Republic, which has changed a lot over the decades. They're very much a sort of representative of Israel's point of view today, which is fine. But back then, they were an anti-communist, across-the-board, very serious liberal publication, sort of Kennedy-type Democratic liberals. And I had the opportunity to read in depth the considerable effort that President Kennedy had to go to overcome this gigantic opposition to doing anything private. Hmm. Very different world from the way we live today, very close to the Great Depression. And Kennedy laid the foundation for government-business cooperation, therefore, that not only Musk, but lots of entrepreneurs are exploiting. So business is now very much part of the space program. And had Kennedy gone the New Deal, Fair Deal route, the Great Depression route, we're going to have another Tennessee Valley Authority or something like that. I think it would have become even more militarized sooner, something that Eisenhower and Kennedy and Johnson were able to at least delay. But we wouldn't have this great cooperation today. And you're quite right. Nobody gives President Kennedy credit for that or other things that he accomplished, he and his associates, in his brief tenure in office. By 73, there was a CompSat, the Communications Satellite Network, that really defines our lives today, including all kinds of cell phone and all kinds of telephone traffic. That network was strongly established. It made the financial system global. Banks immediately put together their own financial communications network and opened the door to all kinds of really positive things.
And I think you rightly characterize in your column that President Kennedy really showed vision there.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't just about reacting in the moment and what feels right in kind of the immediate future, but trying to take a long-term view of where this could potentially go and the ways in which that path forward might be the most beneficial for the most people. And
yes.
So
both Roosevelt's, Reagan, absolutely, and JFK had this ability to capture people's imaginations, and Eisenhower as well, much underestimated because of all the things that didn't go wrong when Ike was in office.
Right.
And winning a phenomenal accomplishment, but he got it done without great fanfare. These leaders have an unusual ability to address the public sentiments, but also needs of the time.
I do want to touch briefly, we'll only have just a couple of minutes, but the other facet of free speech that you tackled in a different column, and that involved this court decision in Florida. Just briefly explain to our listeners what the Individual Freedom Act, if it had been enacted or allowed to stand, what that would have meant. I mean, its ramifications would have been.
Yeah, the Republican legislature in Florida enthusiastically passed, and Governor DeSantis, with great public fanfare, signed a law that basically infringed considerably on our free speech rights of expression. It's called the anti-woke law. It was directly addressed at people who were pursuing left political, social, sexual ideologies and trying to impose this in elementary school as well as across the board in education. Corporations like Disney, under its really stupid previous CEO, who has just been removed, who were pursuing very radical political agendas. Certainly, school children must be protected from exploitation by any adults with agendas, and they already are, as a matter of fact. But this law was so far-reaching that it, in effect, meant the state was going to become a dictator of what business people, business corporations, and educational institutions could do. And the federal judge, it's a wonderful decision. He quotes George Orwell in 1984, struck this down. And DeSantis will continue to benefit, I'm sure, among conservatives around the country. But it's, we're all fortunate the law was struck down. And I realize we're short of time, but I went on to discuss Winston Churchill and his phenomenal use of independent people and people with independent judgment, especially during the war.
Right, one Frederick Lindemann in
Frederick
particular.
Frederick Lindemann, yes.
Someone who was... you know, probably had views that were sometimes hard to take, but I think...
His personality.
No, right.
His personality. It was horrible personality. He was a chaired professor at Oxford in both physics and philosophy. He had great statistical talent. He was a complete jerk. He was totally offensive. And Winston couldn't get enough of him and brought him into the government when Winston became Secretary of the Navy after the war started. And Lindemann was given free rein to criticize everything the Navy did. After France fell and Winston became prime minister, Lindemann had authority across the board, criticized the admirals, generals, especially the prime minister. What the prime... Everybody has a weakness for yes men, excuse me, yes people, as they become more powerful, presidents and prime ministers especially. And part of Churchill's genius as a warrior and wartime leader was making sure there were independent points of view. And he became Lord Cherwell. Lindemann, actually, he was a terribly lonely person. He actually was able to get women to go out to him with him after he became a minister. He never got married, but he actually was able to... He was a very sad man, but he actually was able to find some sort of... reasonable life as a result of Churchill's patronage. He went to the House of Lords. He was no longer this utterly off-putting, antisocial Celia Sands.
Right.
Churchill's daughter, granddaughter. Well, he's so antisocial, Grandpa.
But part of the point is to not be afraid of those kind of voices that are
Absolutely.
Sometimes contrarian. They might have very, very valuable things to offer in public discourse and in conversations of policy and so on, to be not afraid of those voices with which we might take exception or that come in unpleasant packages.
Yeah, this will require another program or maybe a social media interchange, but JFK especially, but also both Roosevelts, really effective leaders welcome contrary points of view, and I hope we can discuss this at more length.
I think it's one of the most fundamental insights that that we can share about what real leadership means. But yes, I'm afraid the time is the ultimate tyrant here, and our time is up, but I am really glad that we had this opportunity to explore a number of important and provocative issues and questions on today's program. I appreciate this and every other visit we've had and look forward to many, many more.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Means a lot to me, Greg. I really do mean that.
Dr. Art Sear, joining us today again on the morning show here on WGTD. And tomorrow on the morning show, I'll be speaking with, modern technology allows it to be recorded a little later this morning, a conversation with a young girl from Ukraine who has written a book about the experience of experiencing the Russian invasion of her homeland right after her own 12th birthday. We hope to bring you that interview tomorrow on The Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. On to the weather forecast, which is for sunny, breezy conditions, not quite as cold as yesterday. Today's high 36 degrees. Overnight, a low of 29 degrees. Tomorrow, clouds roll in, but it will be mild. Tomorrow, a balmy high of 53 degrees, although our winds up to 35 miles per hour will keep it from feeling like it's 53 degrees. Saturday, sunshine returns and the cold returns with a high of 31 degrees. Sunday, mostly sunny, high of 38. Variable cloudiness as we go into early next week. Right now, no precipitation at all in our forecast. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR.